ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I begin this encounter with an atrocious pun. What type are you? Are you the type who gets riled and excited by a particular topography? Do you worry about fonts? Or are you the type who really isn't too fussed by what a letter looks like? Topography, in fact, has more meanings and sociological context than you might realise. It represents our lives and our times in which we live. So argues Stephen Bannum, who's just been appointed the new designer for the new era of the quarterly journal Meanjin, which of course is a publication close to this program's heart. Stephen is a senior lecturer in typography at RMIT's University School for Design in Melbourne, and he's an internationally acclaimed typographer, educator, and writer on the topic. Stephen, welcome. Can we better understand the significance of letters? I'm going to ask you to give us a quick history lesson. Let's start with typography in jackboots. Tell us about the German black letter.
Yes, well, Philip, the German black letter is probably one of the most explicit examples of the kind of political force in some ways that typography has. So when Hitler, of course, began his atrocious reign, he became quite fixated by the sort of very, very nationalistic voice of the German black letter, which is it's called Fraktur because it looks a bit like fractured letters, if you can picture that. He went with that, of course, because he considered that to be capturing, I guess, the German spirit. In fact, there's a quote here from Rudolf Koch, who was one of the people around at that time, and he said that, you know, German script, as they called it, was the symbol of the inherent mission of the German people, and that it was distinctive and had a sort of very strong nationalistic character. So it was very much the typographic face of an Aryan Germany. The problem with that was that Hitler, of course, was very successful in invading huge parts of Europe and beyond. And every time he would conquer one of these countries and he'd put up signage and all sorts of other things in German black letter, none of the occupied countries, nobody in those countries could understand what the hell they were doing. So the Germans had a real problem. They couldn't actually communicate with their sort of occupied the occupied folk. So they therefore in 1941 did a complete about turn and in fact said that in fact there should be a complete return to classical Roman lettering. And that was very much a sort of pragmatic decision by Hitler to make sure that he could actually contribute to those people that he was actually conquering. It's quite odd. He, in fact, went so far as to describe what was then German script, as I said before. He actually described it as Schwabische Jewish letters. So he accused it of becoming Jewish. So it was a very convenient argument.
I've always been fond of a good old-fashioned serif typeface, but one of the sans serifs, the one I think I most like is called Optima, and that's an expression of post-war optimism.
It is indeed. In fact, the entire naming system of fonts is just as expressive as the fonts themselves. So you mentioned Optima. That's designed by a man called Hermann Zapf, who was actually a calligrapher for Hallmark cards, you know, the cards that you get in your birthdays and so forth. And he would actually do some beautiful work for Hallmark, and then he created his own typeface, Optima. But there are many other typefaces that capture that spirit of optimism post-war. There's, of course, the French typeface Universe, which is really trying to kind of bring the world together in a kind of universal sort of sense. It's almost a utopian notion in the naming of typefaces after the war, but But sort of equally, in the 80s and the 90s, you had Thai faces that were called Exocet and Patriot and Stealth. So the actual Thai face names are every bit as expressive about the time and the place that they were produced as the fonts themselves.
I am very happy that this is not a television program, but sometimes it does pose difficulties when we're talking about a visual topic. Helvetica, tell me about Helvetica and try and describe it to the listener.
Well, Helvetica is probably one of the most well-known typefaces in human history. It's a sans serif typeface, and it emanated from a place called a Huss type foundry near Basel in Switzerland. And it was produced in 1957. Now, it has to be remembered that in post-war Europe, of course, Switzerland happened to escape a lot of the bombings and the atrocities of the war. So it was in a very good place to produce this new font. And Helvetica, of course, refers to Helvetia, which is the Latin term for Switzerland. And Helvetica is, an attempt to be, in some ways, all things to all people. It's a very straight cut typeface. It's pragmatic, one might say, in its forms. It's quite utilitarian, and they were able to distribute Helvetica like no other font had ever been distributed before. So it spread everywhere, and before long, all of the printers all around the world had Helvetica in their drawers. This is in the days of metal type, of course. But Helvetica has gone on to occupy a cultural space that no other typeface has ever been able to achieve. It's quite extraordinary. In 1982, Microsoft produced its version, or a sort of knockoff of Helvetica, called Arial. I'm sure you've probably heard of Arial and seen Arial about. But Helvetica these days can be seen in the branding of Lufthansa, Panasonic, Nestle, Knoll, American Apparel, Kawasaki. The list just goes on and on and on. And when Helvetica turned 50 in 2007, it coincided with the first ever feature-length film about a typeface called Helvetica. So the film was called Helvetica. And it was quite extraordinary to see online endless, you know, birthday cakes being cut for Helvetica, parties going on for Helvetica. So Helvetica is quite an extraordinary typeface, not even just for itself, but for its cultural presence.
Talking to Stephen Banham. Stephen, in the 50s, as cars became more part of our daily lives, a distinctive highway lettering emerged.
Yes, that's right, because, of course, as more people were driving cars, all of a sudden communication was being consumed at ever-increasing speeds and from much, much further away. So typefaces had to kind of respond to this whole new environment. And so it was in some ways akin to what happened in the Victorian era when the automobiles, you know, first started, or when there was modes of transport that were faster than walking, so that you couldn't just have a normal little kind of poster or playbill or something on the street. No one would see it if they're going fast. So type is always responding to societal change, and that's really absolutely fundamental. And I guess at the core of my argument is that typography is an expression of language, and language is an expression of culture, and culture is an expression of us. And that's the way I see that relationship.
Because people were gazing fearfully into the heavens, science fiction became very big in the 60s and the 70s, and that has an impact on typography.
It most certainly does. Around about the time of the space missions, a whole series of typefaces were produced to portray the sort of expansive, exploratory sort of nature of space. So you begin to get a lot of typefaces, which are things like Eurostyle and sort of Microgamma, the kind of typefaces that you used to see in Thunderbirds and science fiction films like District 9 and so forth. So these were expansive Thai faces. So they were very wide in their proportions, and that in many ways echoed the expansion of man into space. It was quite strange. But a very unusual thing happened, though, during or around the time when Stanley Kubrick, of course, was producing 2001: A Space Odyssey in 1968. So when he was shooting that film, the only font that was actually featured in the spacecraft in that film was a typeface called Futura. Strangely enough, at that very same time, with the actual Apollo 11 space program was going on, and of course was going to land a man on the moon in 1969, they also only used Futura on those ships. So every single astronaut meal, absolutely every single label, direction, whatever, it was all in Futura. And in fact, Futura...
You're giving typography an almost transcendental quality.
Well, I would argue that that is indeed the case, because Futura, of course, went on to be typeset onto the metal plate that still sits on the moon, saying, you know, here men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon. You know, we come in peace for all mankind. So that is set in Futura. So these kind of typefaces have this enduring quality, and Futura was particularly appropriate given its name.
So, jumping forward a while, let's see what happened during the pandemic. Did it have an influence?
The pandemic had a huge influence on the consumption of typography, because all of a sudden people were forced in many ways, I guess, to be involved with direct correspondence, not necessarily have it kind of dictated by their office. And I think the pandemic did actually force people to start to have to make some design decisions around typography. Of course, this has been happening for quite some time with the advent of desktop publishing and so forth. But the pandemic also made people feel very, very lonely, of course, and that meant that they had a desire for intimacy, for connection with other human beings. So as a result, we see a huge sort of uptake in scripts and script typefaces. Try to emulate, you know, the human hand, the intimate nature of the human hand. So there was a huge uptake of script typefaces, and also of typefaces that expressed a certain transience, a certain sense of things being uncertain. So we see the uptake of stencilized typefaces, because they also express that sense of the passing, the transient.
Stephen, you are an absolutely fascinating guest. I'm talking to Stephen Bannum. I know about comfort foods. Tell me about comfort fonts.
Yes. Well, it's certainly a human want for comfort. Of course, we all pine for comfort, and there are particular typefaces that tend to answer that human want. Again, during and after the pandemic, there's been a big uptake on what I call sort of friendly American mum and dad typefaces, things like Cooper Black, which is probably the most famous of all of those, Souvenir, Bookman. So these are typefaces that look a bit like they're from the 1970s. They've got big kind of swollen, rounded serifs. They look very, very friendly, very folksy, very, very easy to get along, very comfy. It's almost like slipping on a pair of moccasins or something. That's, you know, so there's been a huge revival of that. And of course, there's been a huge revival of Helvetica, because Helvetica is what I would sort of call the comfort blanket of corporate communication. So if all else is going wrong, you can always rely on Helvetica.
Now, let's go edgier. Transience, pop-up culture, bring us, well, the stencil typeface.
Yes, so stencil typefaces, as the name implies, are typefaces that, of course, have the particular parts of their letter form cut out so that you can, you know, put them up against a wall and spray the stencil and move on out. They tend to communicate a sort of a cultural mobility, a sort of lack of permanence. And if that's sounding familiar to our current, social and economic environment, then that's no accident. So it also coincides, funnily enough, with the geopolitical sort of militaristic conditions that we find ourselves in, such as the war in Ukraine. So there are certain forces that are always interplaying with the demand for fonts.
The next time you visit the farm, Stephen, and I take you up to the shearing shed, there's a whole pile of metal stencils that used to be used to identify the wool bales. I've never looked at them seriously before, and because of my encounter with you, I shall immediately do so. What about identity politics? How was that reflected?
Yes, identity politics, say, over the past 5 to 10 years has really played a part in the world of typography, which might surprise some listeners. This idea of questioning binaries is beginning to seep into the world of typography. So as you probably know, type is divided primarily into sans and serif. So sans serif, without serif, and with serif. And what's happening now with the sort of really open questioning of these is this idea that somehow we sort of need to start to break down the idea of serif and sans serif, that somehow there are particular modes of kind of classification that I guess they're really wanting to rethink all the time. I mean, I think, though, to a certain extent, it's sort of over-anthropomorphizing the typeface, because in many ways a typeface is a typeface. It's not a complete metaphor for community. So I think that's a very unusual argument, but it's one that's still playing out. And of course, allied with that is the idea of gender in typefaces too, that the way we describe typefaces as being masculine or feminine and so forth begins to cast fairly tired stereotypes of what it is to be a woman and what it is to be a man. So these are all up for debate, and this is kind of current debate, I guess, in the world of typography.
Do environmental anxieties find an echo in typography?
Yes, they do. There's been many, many typefaces in the past 10 years specifically produced whereby their structure allows for a lower consumption of ink or toner and indeed even paper. So there's some, I would say, more symbolic than actually effective ways of being able to do that. So one of the most famous is a typeface called Ryman Eco, which is a typeface that looks completely normal at about, 10 point or 12 point, text size. But when you blow it up, it's actually made up of very small, elegant lines. And those lines, instead of being solid, because they're lines, they take up less ink and less toner. So in theory, they trying to do their bit, I guess, for the environmental movement.
I understand that responses to particular typefaces can be, well, quite visceral. Tell me the story about the Holocaust Memorial.
Yes, so there is a typeface called Comic Sans, which was produced by an American type designer called Vincent Conair. And he produced this typeface for a very early game produced by Microsoft called Microsoft Bob. It was like a little dog that would sort of run around the screen. And this was in 1994, so it's going back quite some time. Comic Sans is actually based on the old sort of comic lettering that you would get in early Batman and Superman kind of comics. It was included in Windows 95 and it was exceedingly popular because everybody had access to it. Then, of course, something terrible happened in 2012 in Holland, somebody decided to use Comic Sans as the typeface to be etched into a Holocaust memorial. And it didn't take long for people to protest against this use of the font, because it really did almost make a sort of mockery of the actual monument, and so it was duly taken down and replaced with a far more appropriate typeface. So that's a really extreme example of inappropriate use of typefaces for particular uses.
You're clearly proudly and defiantly Australian yourself, but is there an Australian typography?
It's interesting that you ask that, because that is in many ways a very popular question for Australian design students. And I would say that it's absolutely necessary journey for all young typographers to explore. To answer your question, however, I would say that that's yet to be found. It's interesting, going back to your earlier comment, the first Australian typeface was in fact a typeface designed for branding cattle. So that was the first one. And but to be honest, I think Australia has so much extraordinary sort of cultural multiplicities. It's so sort of multicultural, so complex, that no single typeface could personify this entire nation.
My guest has been the brilliant Stephen Banham, who's a senior lecturer in typography at the RMIT University School of Design. And he's the newly appointed designer for the journal Meanjin. The Meanjin Winter Edition is out on the 15th of June, so you can see the new look that Stephen has given it, and he's written an article for the mag as well. On our next, Ian Dunt on the latest in UK politics, also the ethnic tensions behind the recent clashes in northern Kosovo, and Wikipedia, why there are so few women in there. See you then.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.